Alexis, it is such a pleasure, first of all, to be back on this beautiful campus just south of the LA International Airport. It's been years since I've been here, but I guess you were here when it was still TRW. All of us LA kids remember seeing this building with that sign, now replaced by Northrop Grumman.
Right. I started here in 1981 as a department manager, and I slowly grew within the company. In the middle 90s, I left to try the commercial venture. If you remember, the dot-coms at the time were actually exploding.
Mm-hmm.
So I had some interesting and painful experiences in the dot-com, and I decided to come back, and I'm absolutely delighted to be here.
This division that you run, that you're the president of, you have a lot of things going on. But of course, what we pay the most attention to on this show is space science. When I went on the website, and there's a great description of this division of Northrop Grumman on the website, I was surprised at just how many missions Northrop Grumman has been involved with, beginning almost exactly 50 years ago with Pioneer 1, the very first space science platform built by an industrial contractor. That's quite a history.
We celebrated last year the 50th anniversary of space, and we dedicated one of our streets to Cy Ramo. He is the founder. We do three things here. We are doing science. We are trying to basically push the frontiers with some of the instruments that we build. We do Earth observation because we care about our planet and what actually happens with the climate. And then the last things, we do military work, such as military communications. So we've been in this business for a long time. We've partnered with NASA and with other agencies for the last 40, 50 years. Going backwards, some of the instruments that we've built for Earth observation, the last one was AQUA. That was a wonderful satellite that had an instrument that essentially measured and looked at clouds, looked at land formations, and looked at the ocean. And there's some beautiful pictures where you can actually see sand coming off Sahara and actually flowing into the ocean. You can see pictures of fires, the direction that they're headed, and they're very useful platforms because they give us a lot more information than anything we've had before. Prior to that, we built another platform. It was Aura. And the purpose of Aura was to look at the concentration of trace gases up in the atmosphere. We're talking about looking at ozone, looking at carbon dioxide, looking at methane, in order to look at different interactions of those gases. And that is a part of the climatology that we can talk about maybe a little bit later on. Then we had before then program called Hyperion, which was an instrument that was a multispectral instrument. It could look at landmass with different colors, essentially. It's like you put the filter in front of your camera. The one instrument that probably is the most exciting for me, which is not climate-related but science-related, is Chandra.
Oh, yes, the X-ray telescope.
When I go to my kids' classroom and I actually can see a picture of a galaxy and having the black holes depicted right there and the knowledge that it actually gives my generation, it makes me really proud of the work that's being done. And it's kind of interesting because the galaxy NGC, like Northrop Grumman Corporation, 6240, was discovered to have those two massive black holes. Really interesting. You go to the Smithsonian, they have a celebration, and they give you one of those rolled-up maps, and you open it up, and you see a map of all the black holes, which is Chandra. An amazing instrument. And we go back to TOMS, where we first look at the ozone concentrations in order to see the damage done by fluorocarbons, and back even further. So this is part of our DNA, part of our what we do is science and climate and methodology.
You know, before we talk a little bit about more about Earth observation, I want to ask you about another instrument that Northrop Grumman is building for NASA right now, which absolutely leaves me awestruck. And it has to be one of the most ambitious missions ever, space science missions, James Webb Space Telescope. How in the world are you going to get that thing put together in space?
I'm really excited about this. And part of my excitement comes from not just the sheer feat of putting such a thing together and making it work, but also from the fact as to what it's really going to do. Mm-hmm. The fact that we'll be able to look in time at the near infrared that will give us an idea what happened between the Big Bang and between the time that we can actually observe with a Hubble, I think it's going to open great avenues in terms of our knowledge for that particular time. Astrophysics, where is dark matter? What is it? Dark energy. I'm not saying that this is going to give us an answer per se, but I think it's going to really greatly help in terms of our understanding of the origins of the universe. Mm-hmm. So it's the Hubble is about 2.4 meter aperture, mm-hmm. And we are 6.5. So the collecting area that goes is diameter squared.
As all of us amateur astronomers know, that's quite an increase in gathering.
You know, if you really think about it, is the height of this room is only 8 feet. You need to double that.
Yeah. Mm.
So it's really phenomenal. We are going to send it up unfocused because we don't want to run into the same trouble that we ran on the previous telescope. Mm. So we're going to configure the spacecraft, deploy all the mirrors because they're all folded. We'll deploy the mirrors and we'll do the adjustments of the mirrors by using special actuators in the back in order to get the wavefront that we need. Mm-hmm. So we don't have an issue of having it pre-done in here. We're going to send it up, and we'll do the entire wavefront calibration and correction in orbit.
So it's a little bit like the adaptive optics on Earth-based telescopes, except that once those mirrors are configured, you don't have to play with them anymore.
That is correct. It's exactly the same thing. It is adaptive optics, and it's kind of interesting because the whole aperture, which is about, as I said, 6.5 meters, weighs approximately half of what the Hubble weighs. Mm-hmm. Because the surface is just so thin and it can be adapted with actuators to give you exactly the surface that you're looking for. That's one big problem, is how do you build that telescope? The second problem is, where do you locate it? And then, because it's going to be looking at infrared part of the spectrum, is how do you keep the sun away from it? Mm. So we have to take it and put it. It's called the second Lagrangian point.
L2.
And that's about 1 million miles away. And it's quite a ways away. And it's going to stay in that position. And it's going to always have a sun shield between itself and the sun because it needs to keep everything cold. The sun shield is the size roughly of a tennis court, doubles, not singles. And it's 5 or 6 layers that are specially built. And the equivalent sun shielding capability is an SPF, you know, the SPF that we
sunscreen,
use.
Right.
The sunscreen. You're familiar with SPF 10, 15, 35. This is 1.2 million.
That's good. Well, you're never going to have to worry about a sunburn on those mirrors.
So it's ready to go up on 2013. We are currently in the stage of polishing the mirrors. Mm. So we have completed the development of all of the high-risk, high-technology items, and we went through an independent review last year to make sure that we are at the right technology level.
I could easily spend the rest of your time and mine just talking about the JWST.
I understand.
But let's do turn back to our own planet, to Earth observation. You just, as we speak a couple of weeks ago, dedicated a building to the fabrication of new Earth-observing platforms. You had some amazing people here, a couple who've been on the show recently, Barrion Moore and Charlie Kennel, talking about why this is so important. You apparently feel pretty strongly about this as well, the importance of Earth observation.
I do. 2 points in here, one having to do about the facility and the other one having to do of the why it is important. So facility is actually a wonderful set of buildings, and that's where we're going to build the EMPOS spacecraft. The name of the facility is ECOS. ECOS is the ecology, and it means home. And it's a Greek word that does stand for home, even though it's an acronym really for the environmental observation satellite systems that we're building. So it fits, and the person that came up with the name ECOS got an award and is smart enough to know how to please his management. So it's built with environment in mind. It's in different quadrants, and one is the ocean, one is land. One is stratosphere, and the other one is atmosphere, and you can actually walk through. The light gets piped with fiber optics from the roof. It's waterless systems, and you can just basically see down on the floor. That's the new building, the new facility we had. We dedicated it to atmospheric sciences, essentially, and climatology. When you walk out, you should have a look at the murals that we had painted outside the building. They look very much like the Highland types of murals, except that here we have emphasis between science and environment and how they're related.
Oh, I will. Thank you.
Which brings me to the second part of the science and the environment. A $7 trillion economy depends on climate. Hmm. National security depends on changes in the climate, where people go migrate, where they grow food. Our vineyards in Northern California depend on climate. 12 of the western states are increasing in temperature 70% more than the average. Mm. If that trend continues, I think people will have to start thinking where to plant the new vineyards right now. What is happening with the ice pack and the delta salinity, and is happening with our water? We haven't had any rain in LA since February. Then we had a few drizzle, if you remember.
Yeah.
So all of these things are occurring right now. And the part that most people don't understand is that some of those effects, even though we could bring the emissions down to, let's say, what we had 30 years ago, some of those effects are very long-term effects that would last for a long time. You remember we used to use lead in paint? And we fixed that real quickly. And now the lead levels in the atmosphere are way down. This is not lead in paint. This is not a very simple point solution. This is a much more complicated thing. And let me explain to you why. Climate is governed in general by some simple-looking equations. We scientists always like to think about equations. There are four equations, and the equations are very nonlinear. By nonlinear, I mean that their effects multiply exponentially. It's the standard question that I would ask. Would you rather have $10 million right now, or would you rather have one penny that I double every day for a month? Most people will take $10 million.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the one penny, though, is way in excess of $10 million in 31 days. That's what I mean by nonlinear. It goes exponentially. And we are seeing the exponential behavior. We are seeing basically things that don't follow the normal seasonal pattern, but they're going exponentially. They're moving at a much higher rate. The complexity of the equations themselves, which is, you know, you're talking about the radiative transfer, what comes in terms of heat and what goes out, that's mm-hmm. the sun. You're talking about conservation of momentum, basically how the climate, the clouds, things move around the sphere. You're talking about the location of heats and sinks. For example, sink is something that would absorb CO2. Sink for CO2 is the ocean.
Yeah.
We have
yeah.
had a 23% reduction in the ability of the ocean to absorb CO2. Major effect. Why? We don't understand it. We don't understand why we have a 4-degree increase in the water temperature up in the Arctic. We don't understand why half of the ice cap has melted in the last 10 years.
So even with the most powerful supercomputers, Your model is only as good as the data you can base it on.
Exactly. What I'm trying to say is there are those four differential equations that are highly nonlinear. Now, part of the nonlinearity has to do also with the boundary effects and the starting conditions. You know, the butterfly effect that people are talking about? So you have to worry about some very complicated nonlinear equations. You have to look at boundary conditions. You have to look at how things have started and the resolution of how they have started. You cannot approximate the climate around the Earth by taking giant blocks that are 100 kilometers by 100 kilometers. That doesn't work. You have to make it a lot smaller. So the number of points that you need to measure all the way from the bottom of the ocean up to the stratosphere is huge, and it's three-dimensional. So you need underwater platforms, which we're using right now for current measurements as well as for tsunami prediction. You need surface measurements from ships and for buoys. You need measurements at the 50 to 100,000 foot that you do use UAVs for, like you would fly a UAV through a hurricane in order to look at humidity, in order to look at temperature, and so on and so forth. And then finally up in space, where you look at the full three-dimensional picture. Huge number of data points, and you need to take them every few seconds, the measurements. I mean, that problem, it's not one supercomputer. It's much tougher than that, and everything is so interdependent. You know, whether the ice is new or the ice is old, it has different albedo.
Yes.
How much of the ground is exposed versus not exposed changes the absorption characteristics. It's a very difficult problem. And it's a very significant one, though, because what we understand is some of the effects are already irreversible.
And apparently some of the effects are accelerating at a rate greater than the current models had predicted.
That's correct. The original prediction of the rise in sea level was about 3.1 inches. Now it's gone from approximately 6, a range of 6 to 36. That shows you the uncertainty of the measurement. And 36 inches, if you consider all the infrastructure in Manhattan, is just 2 feet above ground. 36 inches could raise havoc.
So you talked about a $7 trillion economy. It seems that Earth-observing systems are a pretty wise investment and not a very significant piece of that $7 trillion.
Yes, and the one thing that concerns me is right now we are in the golden era of Earth observation. We have approximately 100 platforms that are doing the measurements. That number is projected to get down to 25 in the future. That concerns me. That's point number one. Point number two is we need international cooperation for this venture. Last year we had one, two, three, four, five platforms taking pictures of the same sandstorm. That is a waste of resources. We have to have a system in place. We have to allocate roles and responsibilities, measurements, instruments, orbits to different nations so that we can collectively gather all that information and process it.
Charlie Kennel talked a little bit about this on a show a few weeks ago, international cooperation, and said that, yes, it does look like the Europeans may pick up some of the slack, but that the role that the United States plays, the lead role, is going to be extremely important.
Absolutely true. I think one of the things I have been talking to people, you're familiar with the National Weather Service. We should put together a National Climate Service. And that particular service needs to drive national and international activities. There is work that is being done internationally. There is the GEOS program. It has 76 signatories so far, but it's still in its infancy. Somebody needs to turn the gain up. And what an opportunity for us internationally for leadership and for doing something that's good for the planet. I think it's wonderful. It's a bipartisan issue. Everybody wants to do it, but we need to just turn the gain up. And I'm hoping that part of the interview, that's what it does, is get people's sensitivity up that it's here. It's a problem that's important for our kids. What we do now has major ramifications. I saw a commercial about, not a commercial, a statement about 6 months ago that really impressed me. There was a man about my age on railroad tracks talking about the climate and how we had time and how we could, you know, basically address the issue, and you can actually see a train coming. And the train is getting closer, and he's talking about the climate and about the issues. And then he steps off the train track, and what you see behind is a little girl. And it was a dramatic image to me because we step aside, but there is the future generation. Things that we do right now make a big difference. And even, as I said earlier, if we stop, the CO2 and the greenhouse gases contribute something very small amount in the energy equation. There are other factors like the heat sinks that we're talking about. How much does the ocean absorb? There are many other factors we don't understand, and we have to spend the time and the energy to find out what is really going on. 20% of the coral is gone away because of the rise in temperature. How does El Nino form? How is El Nino going to interact with the Hubble current? What effect is the Hubble current going to have here if dynamics change? People talk about the currents in the Atlantic changing. Well, when there is a 4-degree increase in the Arctic in temperature, how that's going to affect the Hubble current that controls our climate here? These are questions we don't have answers to. And I think it's really important because it will affect our lives and our future.
I get the strong impression from the passion that you've expressed that you are pretty happy to be in a position where you can help contribute to this worldwide need for more data that is basically, very plausibly, going to save our planet.
I think saving our planet is a very good way of look at it. I think 25 years ago, Buckminster Fuller died. And one of the things that he mentioned that I've always remembered is he talked about our planet. He called it Spaceship Earth. I mean, we are. This is our home. This is our house, our ecos. And we are hurtling through the through space, unfamiliar, cold, irradiated, unfriendly. So we have to take care of it. And the best way to take care of it is to understand it.
The rhetorical question is, I wonder how many major leaders of corporations or this division of a corporation I could have this kind of conversation with. You are obviously still very much a scientist as well as an engineer and a manager of the space technology division. You were once a teacher at Caltech. You taught in your postgrad days. We were talking about the research you did there just before we turned on the recorder. Do you ever miss those days?
I don't. I get the chance here to transmit my knowledge to the younger people coming in. I use my understanding, my depth in subjects and my breadth in subjects in terms of understanding our problems and our programs. It makes this job more complicated but much more rewarding because fundamentally we're not here to build washing machines. And the spacecraft are extremely complicated, and they do a wonderful job. Understanding how they work, what they do, what the effects are, and being able to communicate it to other people is more gratifying to me than teaching a course. And it's interesting because when we talked about climate and you talked about leadership, maybe we don't have that many people around now. But when I talk about climate and the importance of climate, it's the Y generation, it's the millennial generation, it's my kids. My kids are really interested in climate.
Yeah, mine too.
So it's that generation that is interested. So I see a lot of future leaders sharing the same passion. And I see it a lot more than I see it nowadays.
Alexis, it has been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for letting us come here to the home of Northrop Grumman Space Technology and up to your office and have a conversation with you about the research that Northrop Grumman is supporting and your part in observing our planet as it goes through changes that we all need to be much more aware of.
Thank you very much.
Alexis Livanos is Corporate Vice President and President of the Northrop Grumman Space Technology Division. He has a distinguished background throughout science and engineering, recently inducted into the National Academy of Engineering here in the United States. And we are speaking at the beautiful campus, and it does look like a beautiful college campus, just south of LA International Airport here in Southern California.